From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today we've got a great show. You know, we're building the Backyard Advantage, and at the heart of the Backyard Advantage is really the people that bring our backyard together. And today on the show, really a guy that is at the heart of this Backyard Advantage for me, for sure, is Greg Conley. He is the founder and CEO of Cora Power. You may know him as the founder of Trifecta, built a very successful meal delivery service, organic meal, that's doing well. And now he's on to something new. So we're going to hear about that. But he's also one of these guys that's got experience in these a variety of areas around growing businesses. And at the heart of growing a startup, you've got to raise money. And so today we're going to be sharing like the top three secrets that you need to know around raising money. And we're going to kind of take you through the stages of the raise and get Greg's perspective. But before we get into that, maybe tell us about Cora Power. I alluded to it. This is your new startup and it's super exciting. So give us a little background on that.
Yeah, thank you. So yes, a lot of people know me from Trifecta. So to give people the kind of recap there, step down as CEO last May after more than 10 years, which was, you know, a little bit emotional for sure. But, you know, Trifecta grew very big, did over $500 million in revenue while I was CEO, had a phenomenal time there. But, you know, ultimately got to a point where I was like, hey, am I going to do fresh food and meal prep for the rest of my life? Or am I going to get back into high tech, which is, you know, really where I started my entrepreneurial career in the San Francisco Bay Area in software. You know, that's really where I learned how to raise capital and build businesses. And a lot of the stuff I'm trying to bring here to Sacramento, you know, with the Backyard Advantage, and launched Cora. So Cora is a smart home energy platform business. So what that means simply is we make several pieces of hardware, a smart panel. So imagine your electric panel with a computer in it, along with a hybrid inverter and a modular battery stack. So think of a really sophisticated battery for your home. And we designed it to be fully vertically integrated all the way up to the grid, meaning we can trade power on the wholesale energy market, which has now just gotten deregulated for the first time in the history of the grid in the United States, you know, 120 years of grid, and consumers have never really been able to access the wholesale energy market. So that's really the market opportunity we're going after. And, you know, we want to make the hardware as, you know, high tech and cool looking as possible so that people are really excited to get into it.
Well, power is a big concern for all of us right now. Obviously, you know, energy prices are going up. There's a shortage of power, you know, with the AI and all the different data centers and, you know, just growth. What's the biggest problem you guys are solving?
So there's several major tidal waves hitting the power markets at the same time. You mentioned one of the biggest, which is AI data centers. And for that, I mean, the comparison I give people is some of these data centers are 10 gigawatt data centers. And you think about that and you go, what the hell is a gigawatt? Well, a nuclear reactor, like a full-size nuclear power plant, usually produces about 1 gigawatt. So these data centers are like 10 nuclear reactors worth of power needs. So they're enormous. So there's AI. There's also EVs. I drove here in a Tesla. EVs are about 25% of all the cars on the road in California at this point. And there's also other major ones, largely the one that we're targeting, which is home electrification, meaning people are taking out their gas stove or their gas water heater and replacing them with induction so their kids can't get burned, or they're more energy efficient and can use their solar, you know. So home electrification is actually one of the major waves as well, and really the one we're going after.
Exciting stuff. So you'll actually save the consumer money and ultimately they'll use power more wisely.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest cliches that is completely true in business is what you can measure, you can manage. And if I asked you how much the various things in your house used right now when it comes to power,
I have no idea.
Nobody has any idea because we have a big metal box on the side of our house that's like an 80-year-old piece of dead technology. So that's a big part of our value add for consumers is they can see where their power's going. I happen to live in PG&E territory. My PG&E bill is now around $2,100 a month. Oh my goodness. And I have 36 solar panels. I'll bet yours is even bigger out at Haneyville.
We have quite a bit of square footage between all the houses and buildings and stuff. So yeah, it's a lot of power.
So it's probably enormous. And so yeah, when I was
I'm afraid to look at the bill to tell you the truth.
Yeah, when I was like, I'm spending $25,000 a year in power, it just seemed bananas. And I called PG&E and said, hey, how do I get my power bill down? And their answer was, we don't know. Because they can't see past the meter to give that very useful information to the consumer. So, you know, we really want to empower consumers to take control of their own energy future and, you know, in the process, save a bunch of money because you can charge your batteries when power's cheap or free, and then you can discharge it from 4 to 9 p.m. when, you know, power is really expensive.
All right, well, let's talk about raising money. I promised our audience that we're going to get not just inspired by Greg Conley, but we're going to get educated as well. And so I wanted to go through the fundraising journey, if you will, and then at the end we'll share some secrets about that a lot of people don't really think about as top of mind for raising money. So a lot of people, everybody starts at the beginning, right? So with typically bootstrapping at some level, and then maybe you go to your pre-seed round. Maybe talk us through that journey a little bit. Who are investors and what's the plan?
So I've raised throughout my career, which is now about 22 years of entrepreneuring, over $45 million in capital, largely venture capital. And these are my secrets now. So I will give people, I think, kind of the three critical elements of raising capital. And you know, we can start with one, knowing the stages of the venture process in general, all the way from what you said, which is bootstrapping.
All the way to exit, I guess, right? Because that's part of the...
Or, you know, maybe IPO. I had dinner with Dale Carlson and Dave Lucchetti, and, you know, Lucchetti family is a great example of, you know, generational business. I don't know exactly how big that business is, but 4,000 employees, I mean, they're making a lot of money for a long time now. So it depends on what your particular goal is, but today the easiest place for people to start is through a platform like Carta. Carta is going to give you a lot of, so this is my secret number one, is, you know, educate yourself and use the right technology. So Carta, I'll give you an example. I just recently joined one of their quarterly update podcasts where they will give you all the information on valuations that most seed rounds or Series A's all the way up to Series E's and IPOs are raising at for your particular segment, for the market in general. So you can see what you should be raising at valuation-wise, you know, how much money people are currently raising, is it a harder market, an easier market, et cetera. It also gives you the tools to do something like a safe note to get started. So for Quora, we wanted to do a local round because for the most part, I immediately went to venture capital in San Francisco and Boston with Trifecta. And we, you know, wanted to give people kind of local backyard people first shake at investing in the business. In order to do that, we raised something called a safe note, which was popularized by Y Combinator and makes it easy to not fight about valuation early on in the process with investors. Carta today, you know, this is going to turn into an
app. It's kind of the industry standards, what we use at the Growth Factory to help manage our portfolio.
Your portfolio. There are other platforms out there. If, you know, if you want to force Carta to be price competitive, they will, you know, bid against other people. But it can issue the safe note, manage it, manage the data room, manage the cap table, all the different elements that you need in order to educate yourself about what's happening in the market with fundraisers and do all of the management within, you know, one unified platform. And my God, did I wish they had something like this 20 years ago. I mean, I know you remember, you know, managing things on spreadsheets and going to lawyers for all the, you know, documentation and everything. It was a nightmare. And you predominantly did convertible notes or seed rounds or bootstrapped, you know, right. I racked in a bunch of credit cards myself. So yes, the process is much easier, much more professionalized, much, much more straightforward now because of platforms like Carta. So that would be kind of secret number one is educate yourself and then use the right tools to fund.
And then educating yourself, obviously you can educate yourself at some level through Carta. Carta is a great platform. What other ways might I educate myself?
So obviously watching podcasts like this, go on YouTube, use AI. I mean, I love Google, but I probably spend far more time on ChatGPT today, probably doing 80 to 100 AI queries a day at this point. So that can be asking about, you know, market economics or your particular industry. And you do want to double check, you know, sometimes the platforms do give you the wrong answer for market research or other things. But, you know, ultimately, those tend to be the main areas that I educate myself. I also read a number of books. The one I always recommend is Raising Venture Capital for Serious Entrepreneurs. Phenomenal book. Explains, you know, all the ways to graph out the different ways things can go, because, you know, I forget who it was on your podcast, but someone used the quote, you know, treat equity like gold and not like candy. That's a very common mistake I see is entrepreneurs will have given away 20-30% of the company to advisors and stuff prior to them even like raising any capital, and you have to like recap this thing in the first year.
Yeah, it's, even as investors, we look at it, if you've given away so much of the company, are you really going to be incentivized to take this thing, you know, for the next 5-10 years or to the finish line?
Yes.
So yeah, you have to have your skin in the game.
Yeah, they have to have planned out kind of each stage and what's likely to happen at each stage of the fundraise process to optimize to a point where the company's got, you no longer need runway because you've taken off, you have lift, you're producing, you know, enough EBITDA that the business can scale on its own.
Yeah. In terms of like identifying who your investors are there at the beginning, you're educating yourself. So kind of knowing what type at the seed stage, or excuse me, the pre-seed and let's call it bootstrapping friends and family area, where should we be looking for the investor as far as the education? Who are the people that invest in these really early stage companies?
There are a number of kind of key people I tend to reach out to, but obviously accelerators in whatever particular city you're in. You know, here in Sacramento, Growth Factory is, you know, kind of a leading player. And then on the VC side, we also have Moneta, who's, you know, kind of like your guys' big brother right
and
now.
And angel investors.
Yeah, angel investors. There's always angel investor groups. You can look up angel networks. I did a lot more angel investment pitching on previous companies prior to me having a big network. I think that kind of develops over time. But you need to go out to these events and, you know, shake hands, go to charity golf tournaments, go, you know, be out in the scene interacting
put
with
yourself
people.
Out there.
Yeah, because that's how you're going to get a lot of those warm introductions. I mean, and I'll give this as secret number two. You know, warm introductions, absolutely. I think we got this answer originally from AI. Absolutely are key.
Way better than cold calls.
Yes. I mean, you going to an angel event and pitching, yeah, you may raise some capital from that. But for the most part, you know, I have been blown away by how quickly we've been able to get Cora into the scene and scaling from all of the introductions we made.
And I can, you know, I want to sort of vouch for that as somebody who makes investments, I guess for a living. I guess it's my job now to do this. And I get emailed or LinkedIn messaged, I don't know, 5 times a day, I would say on average, of somebody with a,
at least,
I have
the
startup. Yeah, 10, it could be more. It's just like, I can't even look at them. And but if one of my friends makes an introduction, I'm having
totally
a meeting with
different.
The guy or the woman. Yep. So, yeah, it's like zero look. I don't care how sexy the product is. An introduction, kind of regardless of what the product is, I'll take the call.
Yes, and I tend to try and triangulate on like key people that are going to, on the business development side of the company, that are going to be able to help in that way as well. Like one of the first people that we did actually, you know, give equity to and bring on as an advisor was a guy named Ben Finkler at UC Davis. He's the director of the Energy and Efficiency Institute. Phenomenal guy, but he walked me into SMUD, walked me into Southern California Edison, walked me into PG&E, you know, brings me to the energy summits. Like the amount of intros this guy's made right out of the gate to the key people in all these different areas has been phenomenal, because he's a kind of a kingmaker in my particular industry. So you want those people both on the investor side and the business development side to help you scale up a business quickly.
Yeah, in terms of those investors, and Billy, and this is kind of, I might be sidetracking this a little bit, but the warm intro piece, what about building your advisory board? Many times people get an advisory board with seasoned entrepreneurs, which is cool, but building an advisory board with people who can provide warm intros.
Yes.
That's a more valuable, because it, at the early stages, it's just hard to get appointments. It's just hard to get in the door. They don't know about you yet. So if you can have an advisory board or a board that can open doors for you, that's pretty enormous.
Yes. And it, specifically for whatever particular market segment you're in. I mean, this guy literally is a director of a division. I mean, he was making intros to Honda and Panasonic and, you know, major organizations, because they really respect the research that comes out of the UC system. So it automatically gives me a leg in to some of these phone calls. Like Panasonic is not going to take my cold call. Mm-hmm. Like they're a massive conglomerate. So it's, it has been particularly useful for me to ramp things up very quickly. You know, prior to coming here, I literally had lunch with the chairman of the board of SMUD, who's a phenomenal guy, you know, talking about us hopefully putting something together with SMUD in the near future to really take advantage of the backyard advantage. Because really you know, we're in the utilities and energy space, and we happen to have one of the best utilities in the entire world right here in our backyard.
So. Yeah, and a shout out to Paul Lau, to the CEO. That he's, I mean, they're forward thinking in their approach. They want to be a part of the entrepreneurial ecosystem, if you will. They want to help Sacramento entrepreneurs and innovators to figure out things that are going to, you know, help them really indirectly 100%. Or directly.
Yeah. I mean, we can help them directly. And yeah, Paul was, he's on the board of GSEC with me. I immediately emailed Paul and was like, you don't know me yet. You've only seen me on some Zoom calls, but can we grab lunch? And, you know, we grabbed lunch and I was like, should we even build this? Does SMUD or utilities even want this? And he was like, oh yeah, build this thing as fast as you can. So that was one of my first kind of market validations was Paul. And yes, awesome guy. Definitely.
That's great. Okay, so let's stay on the warm intro. So that's secret number two, is get a warm intro. Any other thoughts about developing the warm intro, other than like put yourself out there and show up?
I have found that intro-wise, the best way to approach people is to ask for advice as opposed to asking for money. I'm sure you've had other people say that. It is, I think, kind of well-trodden, but it puts people in a much more relaxed situation when you're actually sitting down with them talking about the business, because you're going into the conversation asking them, hey, can you give me your perspective on this? Or how do you think I should handle XYZ that you're really good at, et cetera? And in the process, you're telling them how amazing this new business is and why you're going to have this rapid product market fit and scale. And, you know, and
I
then,
feel like it puts you on the same side of the table instead of we're sitting on this other table, the other side of the table. What's it worth and what do I get for it? Mm-hmm. It's more like, hey, we're teaming up to help solve something or build something, at least for that conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the way I end up phrasing it at the end of the conversation, if it's somebody that I like, I'm an acquaintance with from the community or a friend with or something, is I'll say, you know, at the end, I'm like, oh, well, do you know anybody that would be interested in getting involved, you know, on the investor side for X round that we're raising? And every time I've said that, people are like, oh, me, actually.
And so you get that, plus you get a warm intro, plus they know the other people as well many times, because, and a lot of times that I don't know if they call it social proofing, but if, you know, if Tyler Smith went in on that deal, oh, I better have a piece of that too.
Oh, 100%. Once you start building a critical mass and, you know, people start investing, then especially if they're well-known entrepreneurs, people are like, oh, wow, this is the new hot thing and I need to get into it right now. Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. Third secret. Is there a third secret?
I mean, good Lord, there's a lot of secrets. Okay, so let's go past. Yeah, yeah. So for third secret, let's go past like Safe Note to, you know, Series A or even Series B, which is how far I've gotten, you know, into raising the deck a million. So Trifecta Series B, we raised $20 million on a $200 million pre-money. And for that, it was largely about, you know, we did go out and get investment bankers. We even did that candidly for the Series A process. So making sure the company's phenomenally well organized. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to give them, you know, 2 to maybe as much as 5% of the raise. And it is the best money.
The investment banker.
Yes.
He's your broker or she is your salesperson and helps take, they do a lot of work, but they help take a lot of the emotion out of a deal, just like a real estate transaction.
Yes, and they are able, they allow you to like back channel conversations much easier where they're getting perspective maybe from the other team's investment bankers or directly talking to the other, you know, entrepreneurs or, you know, venture capitalists or private equity firms or whatever it is. So it allows you to really triangulate on the deal much more effectively because it's not you asking the questions. But the analysts are going to make your financial model flawless because you are going to live or die by that financial mm-hmm. model. I think an early stage mistake I made as an entrepreneur is I'm like, well, we'll make the financial model look incredible and then we'll get the money. And then whatever happens, it doesn't really matter. We'll, as long as we're growing quickly, like they are going to compare you to what financial model you gave them when they invested, no matter what, even if you revise it with their approval 10 times after that, you're always going to be compared historically to that financial model. Now, entrepreneurs want to know why. Well, if I'm a venture capitalist, Mark Haney, it's because I'm using these forecasts to build up my, you know, investment rate of return, my IRR forecast for my fund. So, you know, your LPs want to know how well the, you know, limited partners want to know how well the fund's going to do. And you're going to base that off of how well you're expecting these businesses to do based off of the models that they sold the venture firm on. So I think having a very high level of like rigor when it comes to doing your financial modeling is absolutely critical, and using, you know, an investment bank to raise those bigger rounds is also absolutely critical.
Well, let's talk about the way we choose what investment banker to use, because really the right investment banker is better than the most famous investment mm-hmm. banker. There's people that are sort of in tune with your industry and your type of company that are dialed into the decision makers in and around that industry.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you'd be amazed that there are very specialized silos within a lot of the investment banks. And there's tiers of investment banks. I mean, all the way at the top, you've got like the Goldman Sachs A-team of the world. I mean, these guys can like will a deal to get done. They're so incredibly good. We've used what I would consider like some upper mid-market firms. So we use William Blair to do our Series B. They're still a very big firm, phenomenal team, specialized in that case, technology and consumer, which were the two industries we were playing in. We've used Nomura, you know, when we explored various different M&A opportunities, as well as in 2021 when we looked at potentially doing a de-SPAC, you know, and taking the company public. We got 7 different term sheets to, you know, de-SPAC the company. So a lot of different value add areas that, you know, investment bankers can bring, but you want one that's like at the right tier as you. So for our Series A, we used a company called North Point Advisors out of the Bay Area. Now, they've raised like $100 billion in capital or something, which sounds like a big number, but that compared to like Goldman is, you know, Goldman's raised like trillions of dollars for people. So they were small, boutique, but still very good, very professional, ran a very good process. I, you know, can't vouch for them enough.
And I think in most industries, there's people that are sort of the known, even though they might not be the biggest investment banking group, mm-hmm. they're really known within the niche. So they're just connected. They can text you know, the people around the board that might, you know, that are investing into these type of companies, because they helped the last several companies raise or exit within that area.
Yes. And they're already going to be connected with the right VC firms, you know, the right M&A partners. They've probably run a number of M&A processes in your space. And that's how sometimes people will stumble into an M&A transaction, is they'll be raising a Series A, like a good buddy of ours. And, you know, somebody like Fidelity will come along and go, hey, instead of raising a Series A, why don't I just give you $80 million and now I own a majority of the company? Mm-hmm. You know, that type of stuff does happen. And it happens more frequently than you think, where people are out raising around and they end up, you know, ultimately getting acquired or getting a strategic investment because they were talking to the right VC firms, the right investment bankers, et cetera.
Okay, so first, so just making sure we're here on the secrets here. We promised them three. I know we're going to give more, but the first one was, what was the first one again?
I think we did warm handoffs.
Oh, yeah, warm handoffs are better than cold.
Yep.
Now we talked about how to pick an investment banker, which is huge.
Yes, and I think what we actually did is first. Warm handoffs, I think, were second. The first one was like getting the right tools and platform. That's when we talked about like Carta, you know, understanding valuations in your space, like, you know, what is a safe note? Should you have a cap? Should you have a discount? Do you have enough credibility to not do it with a discount? Mm-hmm. You know, a buddy of ours is credible entrepreneur, highly successful, and he's doing his safe note with, you know, no discount, and more power to him. He can demand that. If this is your first rodeo, you cannot raise a safe note without a cap and a discount. Don't kid yourself. You know, like, you got to make it worth it for the investor as well. So I think that is, you know, important to know what stage you're at.
Don't overprice it. Don't ask for too special a terms if you haven't earned that yet.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Like, you will trade as an entrepreneur based on, you know, the level you're at. And that was, we'll give you top secret number four, which was, I think, AI secret number three when we were game planning this, investors do bet predominantly on the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that is one of the things that's helped me raise this safe note so incredibly quickly, is I've got a track record. I did $500 million in revenue, you know, while I was CEO at my previous company. Mm-hmm. In a little over 4 years, we scaled to over $100 million in ARR. Like, investors can look at that and go, okay, this guy knows what he's doing. He's going to ramp this thing up. I'm not going to give him money and it's going to disappear into the abyss, because he's figuring out as he goes, you know, figuring it out as he goes. So, you're for sure betting on the horse. That's something you in particular have talked about quite a bit.
I have. And it really, you know, so betting on the horse, of course, somebody that has a track record like yours is a better bet on average than maybe somebody who has never built a company before. But even as an innovator with a great idea and a lot of passion and conviction, and a communicator and a great storyteller, and somebody that you can tell has humility, that's the type of person we might bet on. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't necessarily be his idea only. It would be a part of it, but we might bet on his or her, the way they carried themselves and their approach to them, because we really do bet on people. Even if they've lacked some experience, they might have a lot of these other things that look a little bit less tangible, but they're real.
Oh, 100%. And some of the best entrepreneurs, like, hit it out of the park on their first shot. You know, everybody jokes about people like Elon Musk. Like, his first terrible company, Zip2, made him a lowly $28 million. You know, that's still a huge success for, you know, a 20-something year old. So, yes, I think for a lot of people, like, prior to them being entrepreneurs, you probably have a phenomenal spidey sense for people at this point. But I can usually tell meeting somebody is this somebody that's going to go all in? Mm-hmm. So if they tell me, oh, you know, I'm going to keep my job and I think I'm going to work on this on, you know, weekends, like, they can get away with that for the first few months, but eventually you got to jump off the cliff. You know, nothing is going to make this a success more than desperation. Like, if you're not panicked that you're going to let your team down or run out of money or whatever else it is, like, that for a first time entrepreneur, in my opinion, is very mission critical.
One of the things you mentioned, spidey sense, and, you know, authenticity I think some people have a knack for picking up people that are BSing them. And of course, these companies are going to pivot. Every startup's going to pivot at least once. But to have somebody who's got enough humility and doesn't know it all, so enough authenticity so that they don't come across like they're BSing me, and enough authenticity to understand that that's the type of person that will probably be able to think on their feet and react, and enough humility to understand they don't have all the answers at the beginning.
Yep.
And it's, I think it's getting more and more difficult, too, to BS anybody, regardless of me being maybe a people person or somebody who's older or whatever. I think with the advent of technology and AI, you can't make false claims because, you know, we're going to do, it's pretty easy to do some amount of research very quickly to see if your assumptions are even in the ballpark.
Yep. I mean, I know your partners, Rick and Ali, you know, talk about like Venture OS and Venture AI. Like you can take a deck and just feed it into Gemini or ChatGPT or something else and be like, okay, you know, what hard questions should I ask about this? What concerns should I have about this business? Does this financial model, you know, make sense based on the standard unit level?
What question should I ask to see if this person is bullshitting me?
Yes. I mean, I literally ask AI questions like that. And, you know, you oftentimes get like very valid and relevant answers. So yes, I do think that is quite a bit harder for, you know, BS artists. But, you know, you're going to filter a lot of those people out anyway. What I do think it does do, though, is give entrepreneurs an advantage to absorb a ton of information very quickly. I mean, that one of the biggest differences with Quora, like I was a software guy, you know, I can write some code, et cetera, but getting into hardware, I mean, that's a whole different level of technology. I mean, there's little printed circuit boards inside this mic that we're using right now. And for devices like we're making, these are, you know, very sophisticated devices. And I'll literally be in engineering meetings and they'll use some acronym or talk about, you know, some resistor, you know, metrics. I'm just like in ChatGPT, not interrupting the conversation to get them to constantly explain things to me. I've got AI explaining things to me continuously in the background. Mm-hmm. So I'm following along with all the engineering conversations and hugely educating myself on the industry, the technology in the space, competitor research, you know, even potential opportunities for the future. I've asked AI like, hey, what are some, you know, market holes in this particular space that nobody's currently addressing that could be major value add? And it will give you sometimes very clever, you know, answers based on the information out there. So,
yeah, very much so.
So yeah, hugely powerful tools. I'm sure everybody's talking about AI at this point, but you know, it is undoubtedly something that is going to help you in your fundraising journey in a major way.
Okay, I'm going to come up with a fifth secret. This is one that I stole from a mutual friend of ours, Brandon Brown. And he
Brandon's
was talking,
the man.
Yeah, he built Grin, and that's a company that scaled well, really well in influencer marketing, and he raised money.
Yeah, I think he raised Series B. $180 million.
Yeah. So yeah. He did a nice job. And the one thing he said, he didn't phrase it exactly like this, but treat it like a sales process and treat the fundraise as a process, a sales process, which I think in some ways means it's a numbers game. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of touch points and a lot of communication and things like that when we go to make a, you know, some of this stuff has a long sales cycle. So begin the touch points early on and do all the follow-up throughout time so that you treat this almost like a long sales process with everybody that's in this investment pipeline, if you will. And so those, I always thought that was interesting that it really is a sales process and kind of a numbers game at some level. All the other stuff matters, but it takes a lot of hits at some level to get the best opportunities to come.
100%. And the way the hits where you do get a no, because I even on Quora, I've gotten some no's from some VC firms that were like, hey, this is, they're largely like, this is too early stage for us. Mm-hmm. My response to that isn't like, oh, okay, well, you know, thanks for your time. It's, hey, do you mind if I send you quarterly updates so you can follow along in the journey, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And 100% of them have been like, absolutely, believe, you know, when you guys get traction and are raising a much bigger Series A or B, you know, we love to cut bigger checks. We love to get involved at that stage. So I think it is a numbers game in the beginning when it's like a safe note or a seed round or even maybe a Series A, you're going to be doing a lot of the numbers game stuff yourself mm-hmm. as the entrepreneur or partnering with an early stage, you know, VC, you know, fund like Growth Factory to do a special purpose vehicle or, you know, some other way to raise capital for the business. Or if you do, you know, later stage, like we mentioned, if you're working with an investment banker, that is where I think a long time ago, I learned the process in like great detail from working with investment bankers because they're going NDAs out to 150 firms. Then they're going teaser out to 150 firms. Then they're going, you know, who's interested in getting a fireside chat with the full deck? And that go, you know, maybe that narrows down to like 50 firms. And then it's like, okay, 25 of them want fireside chats. So you're like, boom, I'm doing an hour long fireside chat. Then maybe 15 want to do 3-hour deep dives. Like it really is like a sales cycle process, mm-hmm. even at the, you know, much higher level, big rounds. And something Brandon did, I don't know if he tooted his own horn on this, but I will do it for him, is he played hardball and, you know, in my opinion, in some ways hard to get in his fundraising rounds. So when venture capitalists or private equity firms feel like this is a hot deal that they want to do and someone else is going to snake it from them, that is where you have like the highest probability of driving up the valuation of that particular round. Yeah. Now, I still suggest people pick the right partner, you know, if even if it's taking a $30 million haircut on valuation or something, but for most people, driving up the valuation is important at those later stage rounds.
The other thing I've seen is as an early stage investor is that the companies that communicate well with their investors, right? When the lines of communication are open, when there's regular updates from the startup to the investor, that there's a trust that builds. It's almost like part of the sales pipeline, if you will, because a lot of times you might go get your pre-seed round, some of those same people might go into the seed round. Some of the seed round might go into the Series A. And at some point, we may drop out. But those first couple, three rounds, mm-hmm. you might have this, your current investors, there might be 20 of them. And you want to keep them all engaged in case you decide to offer it up for them to invest in future rounds or need them to invest into future rounds. So to me, that's part of the sales process almost is expect as part of your fundraising journey to be staying engaged with those initial investors because they're part of the future and they're part of, mm-hmm. you know, what other people might use for due diligence as well.
And they probably have carved out part of the fund for follow-on rounds. So you could probably mm-hmm. tell people what percentage is normal. What I've seen is it's usually like 30-ish mm-hmm. percent of the fund. So for entrepreneurs, you got to think of it as like 70, let's say a fund has $100 million in it. 70% or 70 million of the fund is going for initial investments. And then 30 million is for them to double down on winners.
Yeah.
You know, they want to pick the companies, you know, David Sachs says it best in the All In podcast. He's like, let your winners ride. Like you want companies that are killing it to be the ones that you're doubling down on. That's how you ultimately drive more returns for the fund. I mean, I don't know if it's public knowledge, so I won't name names. You can name names if we can. But recent company in the Growth Factory Ventures mm-hmm. portfolio in Fund 1 has already sold, which is a very early exit for such an early vintage. But I believe you guys doubled down on them, correct?
Yeah, we were the first check-in. Yeah. We sat right over there, the first mm-hmm. meeting, and first check-in. And then we continued to take our pro rata rights, mm-hmm. maybe plus a little along the way. And so it was a good investment for the Growth Factory. But I don't know if we're able to announce that yet either. But yeah, we want to double down on our winners in terms of that strategy as a venture capital firm. I think it's a super common venture capital strategy is to sort of double down on your winners.
Yeah. So that's something that I would just have in the back of your mind as an entrepreneur is like, know that there's a high probability that your previous investors are going to be interested in investing more as the business scales up. Because now you've done what you said you were going to do. I mean, that's like the most attractive thing an entrepreneur can do for an investor is you're like, hey, we were going to go from zero to 100 million in 2.5 years. And then you do it, you're going to have so much more credibility with people.
Okay, so we've talked about the secrets. We got to 5 or 6 and they're kind of mixed together, but because I, you know, derailed the convo a little bit. But what are the mistakes? Maybe go top 3 mistakes that you see founders making in that fundraising journey. I have a couple that come to mind, but I'm kind of like, what do you see?
I would say, I mean, some of them are the inverse of what I've said. So, people not educating themselves on how much they should be raising and at what stage and how much money they're actually going to need. And they end up either giving away a ton of the money to early stage investors and that, or a ton of the business. And that is a really difficult thing to like renegotiate with investors down the road. So, you know, I've seen companies that have raised $500,000 and, you know, 50% of the company is already gone. And you're like, okay, well you're going to need to raise 20 million. So, you know, where do you think the cap table is going to work out with this math? Or they've given too much money to a certain advisor or celebrity or influencer or, you know, something that they think is going to make the business, and they end up, you know, giving them a huge percentage of the company right out of the gate. So I would say not being educated on like proper kind of ramp and cap table management is one of the most like critical mistakes that I see again and again and again with first time entrepreneurs, or they gave too much to their employees. You know, that I'm sure that gets people excited in the beginning, but when they realize that the company's not going to become big and they're never going to become millionaires, it's like, who cares how many shares you have? Yeah. You know?
Yeah. One of the mistakes that I see is occasionally is taking money from just anyone because it's a $25,000 check or whatever. But some investors can be kind of a headache.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They're just sort of, or maybe you get them on your board and they're just a headache and you've got to deal with that headache. It's like being married at some level because they own part of your company. They're their investors. So they have rights and so on. So those, it seems to me that some vetting process around who you take the money from, be a somewhat discerning.
Oh, extremely discerning, especially if it's big money. So I've had, I had a guy, and we won't name names here, but he was a board observer. So he wasn't even a director on the board, who was the loudest guy in the room as a board observer. And his, he almost, made the board meetings very, pretentious and argumentative, even though he wasn't actually a director. And I never would have thought as an entrepreneur that an observer could have like that type of
influence. Don't forget, we're just a small business here trying to get it done.
100%.
And you know how the sausage is getting made, so don't cause problems. Work with us.
Yeah, it's you know, if you have somebody like that is just a challenging personality, you know, if they are a director or an observer or even an employee, like you've got to figure out a way to, you know, either avoid that in the future or buy them off the board or, you know, do whatever in particular to, you know, make it a different scenario. So yes, choose your partners very closely. I know people have said it a million times. It's absolutely a marriage, especially when people have put hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in.
One other challenge that mistake, I'll call it, an underestimation, is people tend to underestimate the amount of bandwidth that it takes as an entrepreneur to raise money, the way that it consumes you, or if you're going to sell your company, your business needs to keep running and growing and doing what it's supposed to do while you have this major, what some people might view as a distraction. It's actually very, very important that you give that a lot of your attention, if not the lion's share of your attention during this process, because it's in a fundraising scenario, it's kind of ongoing typically, but you have to expect it to consume you. So build your life and your business in a way that you don't let that get the best of you.
Yes. And I think that's a great example of a major mistake that entrepreneurs make. Is it's really a whole second job to raise capital. And it's even more difficult in like the bigger rounds. So for Trifecta's $20 million Series B, like that process was probably a 4.5, maybe 5 month process. It was, and that was fast. Like we were hustling, you know, nights, weekends, you name it, to get all the cohort analysis and reporting and financial modeling and all of that done as the questions came up. But during that, you know, 4 to maybe as long as 12 month time period that you're raising capital, the investors that you talk to are going to be watching how you perform month over month compared to even the first model that you've given them in the beginning of the process. So for me, that was highly stressful. Was we were, you know, going through an incredible amount of work to actually do the fundraising process. And that's part of the reason I say investment bankers are worth their weight in gold, is they're going to help lighten the load on a lot of the paperwork and spreadsheets and other things you're going to have to put together, even presentations and pitch decks. But you really are going to be judged monthly while you go through the process with an investor or, you know, a number of investors to see how you're doing compared to your financial model, even during the process. So yes, highly stressful. You know, best way to describe it is like Elon surge mode. Like you got to talk to your wife, talk to your kids and be like, okay, the next 6 months are going to be rough. We're going to have an amazing vacation at the end, but I'm going to have to work until 2 a.m.
I tell people, you have to be a good salesman or salesperson. And the first people you got to sell are the people at home, right? Because look, you got to be okay with this. That's awesome. Okay, well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Any closing thoughts for entrepreneurs that are in the process of raising or thinking about how they might approach this?
Well, I think for sure people should like and subscribe to this podcast, because it's one of the areas that I've learned a tremendous amount is, you know, listening to a lot of the amazing entrepreneurs you bring on here. And you've got, I don't know, almost 800 videos now on the podcast. It's like an incredible repository of information for the entire, you know, greater Sacramento community. But yes, I mean, ultimately, you know, my advice is for people to reach out to amazing connectors like you. I mean, you would be the first place, and I hope I don't blow up your inbox even more, but you would be the first place I would start if I was a new entrepreneur in the region and wanted to get involved in the community, potentially raise capital, meet people that are in my industry, like find the kingmaker of your space and go become friends with them.
Wow. Thank you, Greg. And appreciate everything you've done for me personally. I was an early investor into Trifecta. We're an early investor in Decora. Thank you. And you've done so much to help our startups and the startup community overall in Sacramento. You know, we are lucky to have you here in our region. So thank you.
I appreciate it.
You betcha.
Thanks, Mark.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, at Mark Haney Show, and The Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.